Hi, everyone, and welcome to your monthly dose of emerging sustainability topics. It's Plugged In, where we go deep into emerging sustainability topics from remote regions to the batteries in your remote. I'm Jake Foos, a research analyst on the Insights Transport team. My recent research has been about connectivity in vehicles and how it can facilitate decarbonization. And we have a returning guest who I'm very excited to announce as our new co-host, Grace Zucker.
Hi, I'm Grace Zucker, a research analyst on the Insights team. My recent research has been about microgrids, hydrogen electrolyzers, corporate sustainability, and carbon capture, and I'm so excited to be back to Bully Intelligent People with Jake. This month, we are speaking with Serkan Virgil about his work on carbon capture, utilization, and storage. Serkan is a senior consultant with the Energy Sustainability and Infrastructure team here at Guidehouse. On the Insights team, Serkan works with the trackers we use on decarbonization, carbon capture, and hydrogen. Before working at Guidehouse, Serkan worked as a researcher for the TRT World and a research consultant for Gartner. Serkan is far too humble to brag as much as I would about the fact that he has a PhD from the University of Oxford School of Geography and the Environment, where he wrote his dissertation titled The Association of Natural Resources and Human Conflict, Natural Gas and the Peace Process in Cyprus, as well as a master's in geopolitics, territory, and security from King's College. Oof, that's a lot. Welcome to Plugged In, Serkan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I mean, my name's Serkan. I'm part of the Data Insights team here at Guidehouse Insights. And yeah, I have quite a bit of a obsession over carbon capture, utilization, and storage. So I'm looking forward to discussing with you further.
We're so happy to have you. And speaking on that, I wanted to ask you, Serkan, what brought about your interest in geopolitics of resources?
I think it was actually being from the part of the world that I am from. So that's Cyprus. I was born in Cypress and Famagusta. I'm a Turkish Cypriot. And our part of the world, well, geopolitics matters there a lot more. It's part of your everyday life. It's something that is quite in your face. It's not something that it's just a piece of the news that's transient and ephemeral. It really does shape people's lives. I grew up hearing about the politics of Cyprus, the war and the conflict and the intercommunal strife there between Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots and our motherlands, Turkey and Greece. And my mum and dad came to England in the 1960s and 70s. I was born in Cyprus. My parents wanted me to be born there because we had sort of two-thirds of our family that was still there. So it was kind of nice to be there, nice to have that kind of initial upbringing. And then we came back to England and I grew up here when I was 6 months old. I think I came over here. For all intents and purposes, I spent most of my life and most of my sort of upbringing was held here in the UK. And you kind of just noticed the difference. You know, you weren't like everyone else. You had different priorities, different lifestyles, different family culture, religion, ways of doing things, outlook and life. I mean, people would always talk about Cyprus. The news would always be, we wouldn't miss a single news report, news show on Turkish TV about what's going on in Cyprus. When people would come over to visit us, family, it would always be the old stories, especially when my grandparents were still alive and well, uncles and aunties. We used to have a kind of revolving door policy. People would come in, you know, lots of aunties, cousins, uncles, and nieces and nephews and whatnot. And it would always inevitably, there'd be a portion of the day, a portion of the evening, where the men in the family especially were just going to huddle up and talk the problem out. You know, they'd all become international relations experts. And I absorbed most of it. I was kind of, I grew up knowing about the issue, knowing about the story, knowing about our own family's experiences in the war. You know, my dad would tell me bedtime stories about what life was like in Paphos, where he's from, now on the Greek side in Cyprus. You know, the parents would tell me stories about, their upbringing and how life was then, and how different it is now. So yeah, I was inoculated. It could have been any other way.
You didn't have a choice.
No. I was just, right from the offset.
So you became the international expert that all of your dad and your uncles all became. And then, so how do you go from there to doing decarbonization research?
It was my default largely. So I ended up looking at the peace process in Cyprus, efforts to kind of find some sort of a political solution to the island's division. At the time, it was 2014, 15, there was activity offshore Cyprus with regards to natural gas development. And it so happened that in tandem with efforts to develop natural gas resources offshore Cyprus, there was a peace process that subsequently collapsed. So you would think, based on sort of very rudimentary philosophy, that if event A follows event B, or if event B follows event A, then there must have been some sort of causal link between the two. So headlines at the time were natural gas cause this conflict or cause the collapse of the peace process. So you had immediately that connection between natural resources and politics, at least, natural resource and geopolitics, as it could be also listed as, which was also a kind of example of natural resource geopolitics proper, which I think has always been associated, always been a thing, always been a topic of discussion. There's that famous book by Daniel Yergin, I can't remember the name, but it's like 1,000 pages long, about oil money and political conflict and strife. I think natural resources in sort of human conflict have always been associated in some capacity with each other. And it is a very, at least when I looked at it, a very buoyant area of research from multiple different disciplinary angles. But also, it's not a very, how should I put this? It's not an issue that's been put to rest. There's no kind of conclusive final determination on exactly the nature of the relationship of natural resources and human conflict. There's also different studies. There's an inconsistent approach between different research studies on how to even research on the topic, what kind of questions to ask. There could be, for example, how do you define war? How do you define peace? How would you go about your methodology for your research project? And doing a DPhil, as we call it, so we don't call it a PhD in Oxford and Cambridge, it's called a DPhil, a Doctor of Philosophy. You inevitably ask questions of a very philosophical nature. You try to get to the very sort of principles of first philosophy almost, to understand why people are saying what they're saying and how we can understand causal relations or etiological relations, how we know what we know, relations of ontology and so on. So you kind of, again, get into the weeds from a philosophical perspective, which I like. It's important to kind of ask the fundamental questions. Because all too often, I think some of the humanities and social sciences disciplines, they do not do a good job of letting people know where their tradition comes from in an effort to kind of separate themselves out, differentiate themselves and market themselves. I think they forget to pay due credence to their philosophical underpinning and the kind of the genealogy of their ideas. Some people try to, especially academics, differentiate themselves by coming up with a new coining a new phrase or a new term without telling us, you know, where that phrase might have been repeated or where the idea might have repeated back in terms of history. So it was a very interesting experience, both from a philosophical perspective, from a research perspective, continuation of my long-standing interest in Cyprus and geopolitics. But to be honest, I had enough at the end. I've been, you can imagine me being absolutely saturated with politics growing up at the home everywhere. And then at that time, when I finished my DPhil, it was about 7 years of higher education uninterrupted. And we're different in the UK. I did 3 years of undergraduate, 1 year master's, then straight into my PhD.
Wow.
So, you know, you can understand how I just kind of, I wanted to hear, I didn't even want to read other words, let alone like talk about politics after doing my DPhil.
Yeah.
To move on to the actual thing we pulled you in for about CCUs, can you give us a real quick definition of a CCU? It's carbon capture, utilization, and storage or sequestration, depending on who you're asking. I think most people know about carbon. I think the other three people might not know about it.
Usually you would call it CCUS for the whole thing. So carbon capture, utilization, and storage. If your project is only about utilization, you would call it CCU. Carbon capture and utilization. If it's only about storage, you would call it carbon capture and storage. There are examples where projects apportion a particular volume of captured CO2 storage, a particular portion goes to utilization. So then they could be CCUS projects in the fullest sense of the word. But yeah, we call the industry the CCUS industry.
Can you talk about, related to CCUS, the current capacity that's out there and the planned capacity for it as well versus the carbon emissions that CCUS is trying to mitigate?
So we maintain this, and I'm plugging our tracker here, but you know, I really do rely on it. We use our own internal database called the Global CCUS Project Tracker. We've got about 876 CCUS and CCUS or CCU projects combined, tracked in this tracker, in this dashboard. And they're about 876 with a cumulative capacity of about 1.8 gigatons. That's not enough from a climate change perspective. And I prepared some, I know you'll ask me about this later, about, you know, the relationship between CCUS and climate change and whether we're kind of concentrating on this way too much. But there was a net zero scenario by 2050 published by the IEA that envisioned 1.6 gigatons of CO2 captured and stored per year, rising up to 7.6 gigatons in 2050, even after all other sort of renewable energy reports have been adopted and scaled to their fullest extent and all other decarbonization shifts were completed. So I mean, at least based on that report, there's also similar comparable figures from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. There is a need for carbon capture and storage, not necessarily utilization, but carbon capture and storage. That can possibly also include, and this is the other interesting thing, carbon dioxide removals, so or CDR, and this is most often associated with engineered carbon dioxide removals. So you might have been hearing in the news a little bit about direct air capture, also a little bit of a direct ocean capture that's capturing CO2 directly from ambient air, which is in way, way, way lower concentrations than if you were trying to capture it from a, you know, coal-fired power plant or something like that. But yeah, so there's the CCUS market, then there's CDR market, carbon dioxide removals market. There's also nature-based solutions that I'm you know, particularly less informed about, but they could involve things such as, I don't know, some sort of a marsh or some sort of a natural environmental ecological sort of a system that already captures CO2 for you. It could also be like maybe the Amazon rainforest or something like that. But they're also considered as nature-based solutions that could possibly generate credits. And one of the ways that people have monetized or try to monetize CO2 is putting a price on it through various mechanisms, carbon taxes, mandatory emissions trading schemes, voluntary trading schemes. And in some of these voluntary trading schemes, they try to conceive of carbon credits as offsets. And it's beyond CCUS, there's a whole other kind of market volumes, usually measured in tons of CO2 emitted, that also interplay with a wider industry. So, for example, there are companies who are interested in both in CCUS and in CDR or in DAC, and we try to break them out also. I mean, one of our colleagues, Peter Marin, recently published his DAC leaderboard forecasts. I can't exactly say, I don't have the information with me at the moment, but we're forecasting a pipeline of at least 1.8 gigatons across the entire project pipeline that we look at, going up towards, I think, 2042 at least. And I don't think we're on track to meet these targets set by the IEA, at least. I don't think we're on track to meet some of the overall net zero goals or the overall 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius goals that we have either. So it's not the greatest picture in the world, but from a climate perspective, it's not the greatest picture in the world, for sure. But the CCUS market itself, I mean, it's been very, very buoyant recently. I think it's in its kind of, how should I put this? It's kind of reaching its zenith almost. It's been when I arrived and in Lighthouse in 2020, there was a little bit of CCUS going on. 2021, 2022, there's an absolute explosion in project announcements. It's kind of tapered away. I mean, there's still a similar amount of announcements that were made in 2023 as there were 2022. But that's largely because projects are starting to mature, especially in Northwest Europe and North America. And so you see perhaps less announcements for new projects coming on. Sometimes old projects are reheated. But we're expecting a new project announcement to be kind of concentrated in other parts of the world, like Southeast Asia or the Middle East. Sorry if I went on a tangent there, but this happens when I'm talking
about CCUS. No, it's great. No, and I mean, you clearly saw potential for CCUS. You spearheaded the effort to create the tracker from the ground up. And so in building that and really following these trends for since you inceptioned it, what sort of challenges are you excited for people to overcome, or what sort of solutions are you interested in seeing in the market?
So a little bit about when I first started it, no one kind of told me to start it. And I just kind of saw a gap in our coverage that I thought, hey, this is probably going to be something really interesting. And it also pertains to some of our history as Guidehouse Insights, where we try to be ahead of the curve.
You're a visionary.
In certain respects. Well, I mean, I heard about the story of Peter Asmus and microgrids, right? So, you know, he kind of coined the term microgrid, and he ended up sort of creating all this kind of syndicated research output for us, and he became the man for microgrids. Not that I was ever intending to be the man for CCUS, but I just felt...
You're the man to me for CCUS.
Thank you. That's all that matters. It was a little bit of inspiration to kind of take the initiative and to see what I could do with things. There are other CCUS databases now out there, the Global CCUS Institute and the IEA database. There's also a CCUS map, I think it's called, based in America. I'd like to think ours is better. Ours, we update it daily. We do things a little differently. We have more coverage than the IEA database, especially. But, you know, our database really informs all of our other customer advisory work, not only for our team, but also around the wider company. It's just, you know, our EP practice in particular. So it's been a really, really useful resource, really, really useful exercise. And it's kind of lays a stake for us as Guidehouse Insights to talk about CCUS. Changes that I see, Well, I mean, I've recently been authoring alongside Peter Marin a leaderboard in the carbon capture solution provider. So the actual companies that go out there to capture carbon from emitters being the customers. So I could talk a little bit about that and the changes that I see there.
Go for it.
It seems to me that, yeah, although there are lots of smaller emitters, I think there was some statistic that I saw that 80% of emitters in Europe are individual emitters, are less than 1 megaton per annum of CO2 emitted per year. Even though there are lots of those little ones, carbon capture solution providers usually target the larger ones to begin with. Usually they want to kind of target a foundational emitter or foundational project with a large emitter and then sort of prove their solution and roll it on from there. CCUS technology is something that's been around for over 50 years easily. It began with a process called natural gas sweetening, where you would take natural gas that would have CO2 in it that's acidic. You'd attempt to sweeten that natural gas by removing the CO2. Why? Because CO2 being acidic wouldn't pertain well to the transportation of that natural gas in a pipeline, might cause, you know, corrosion related issues. So the idea was removal of the CO2 from natural gas to purify it, to sweeten it. And that's really when the kind of genesis of at least the separation of CO2 from flue gases being exhaust gases or vent gases, but also, for example, natural gas processing. So natural gas fields and so on, where the natural gas naturally occurs. I use natural there too many times, but you get what I mean. But yeah, that's when it sort of started, the genesis of the industry. And usually the captured CO2 would either be vented or it would be used for enhanced oil recovery. So it would be essentially, very crudely described, pumped underground to liberate any pockets of oil that are for some one reason or another trapped or that you couldn't get out so easily. And usually you would apply it to an oil field that was perhaps reaching the end of its lifetime or its capacity was falling over time. So you would resort to EOR, enhanced oil recovery. You've also got enhanced natural gas recovery. With enhanced oil recovery, you'd pump the CO2 to sort of squeeze the last drop out of the lemon, to speak very metaphorically. That's been the initial history of CCUS as an industry, but we are seeing a very, very, very strong shift towards storage applications instead, rather than utilization applications. Utilization applications would be CO2 being utilized for EOR, utilized for enhanced natural gas recovery, utilized for example, I don't know, chemical feedstocks or food and drink industry, greenhouses to a lesser extent. But we are seeing a shift towards in the market towards storage applications, permanent geological sequestration, for example, over a very, very long period of time. Very long geological period of time. And the market is also across the world largely incentivized towards that end. So in America, you've got the federal tax credits, the 45Q, that gives, and I forget the numbers exactly, Peter will be nodding, shaking his head at the moment, but there is a larger amount of money allocated to storage of CO2 per ton rather than utilization of CO2.
Yeah, because I was going to ask if there's a difference between the actions being taken by smaller and larger players. If it's, we were seeing larger players actually be able to take on utilization of the carbon, as opposed to smaller might be more focused on storage and sequestering just because of cost.
Possibly, but you've also got now a lot of talk about hubs and clusters. Especially here in the UK, they have an industrial cluster-based decarbonisation approach. The UK has kind of tried CCUS 3 times now, so third time lucky. And in the previous 2 engagements or attempts, they've largely focused on singular plants and singular projects. So the industry generally has been shifting towards from what we would call a vertically integrated industry. So that would be one company doing absolutely everything, capturing its own carbon, piping it somewhere, conducting EOR for its own purposes. Now we're seeing sort of horizontal integration, the unbundling almost of the entire CCUS value chain. So you'll have an emitter, someone will come and transport the carbon for you. Someone might transport the carbon and store it for you. So we're seeing that kind of unbundling process, that kind of horizontal integration going on. So with smaller emitters, there is an attempt to capture them in these wider kind of networks of clusters and hubs. But I don't know, it's a case-by-case basis. Sometimes you have in a kind of industrial cluster in a particular part of the world that's just there for the taking, and some of the smaller, more dispersed emitters would naturally not be given priority. But there is an attempt to reach them in latter stages, perhaps, but they're usually not given priority. If there are smaller dispersed emitters or smaller emitters that are not dispersed compared to where the kind of main CCUS activity is going to be taking place, then they possibly be involved as well.
Can I ask you real quick, you use the acronym EOR, And that kind of leads into a question I have of carbon's being utilized and sequestered and stored. What are they doing? What are the applications with this? I know EOR is one of them. So could you define that and then maybe some other ones too?
Yeah. EOR is your classic utilization project. Some people have attempted to say that, oh, well, you know, the carbon's going underground. It's a form of storage, but it'll come back up. And sometimes they'll reuse that same carbon that came up and use it for EOR again. So that would be a classical utilization project. There's another one called enhanced gas recovery. It does exist, but it's, you know, comparatively smaller compared to the EOR industry. You could also use captured carbon in the food and drink industry to get your bubbles and your fizzy drinks. How could we live without them? Could also use it in greenhouse applications. Some of the early CCU or utilization projects beyond EOR were largely kind of concentrated in the food and drink and greenhouse application. There's also applications in the production of synthetic fuels. I know less about that, but I know it's a thing. So that could be interesting too going forward. I don't know how you would describe this. It's probably a form of storage, but there's also attempts to kind of capture CO2 and reutilize in building materials. So for example, minerally bind CO2 in a brick or in a kind of some sort of building material that you can then use thereon in the building industry. I mean, if it's a form of storage that will sort of pass the test of time, you can probably call that a CCS project. But yeah, the debate's still out on that one.
That's super interesting. And with a diversity of applications of utilization and of the captured carbon, I'm wondering how much do you think CCUS can withstand decarbonization efforts alone? Since there's so many different ways to use it, can it be cross-used across so many different industries, or is it something that really needs to be paired with other decarbonization methods to be effective in the grand goal of reducing global emissions and reducing global warming?
I think CCUS is particularly pertinent for the hard to abate sectors. So there are some processes in the world where carbon capture will be a sort of key decarbonization tool. Something, at least in the near term, that is only feasible. For example, in cement, carbon capture and storage has been described as the only feasible technology in the near term to decarbonize that industry. There may be other, in the cement industry, there might be, for example, chemical process that can't be changed. It's not just, for example, that you can use a low temperature heat process or a high temperature heat process instead, but there is a certain portion of that industry, a certain chemical reaction within that industry that necessarily emits CO2 no matter what you do. And in the near term, especially for other hard to abate sectors, CCS has been described as almost a necessity. I mean, you could look at other, for example, electric arc furnaces or hydrogen-based production methods. But I think with carbon capture, it's there at the ready, you know, the technology readiness at the highest level. And it's kind of there for the taking. And also with many kind of what we call post-combustion applications, can be easily kind of retrofitted to a plant. And I'll use another term, to a point source capture plant. Point source capture is where you capture the emissions from point of emission, so the emitter itself. So for example, the power plant or the cement plant or the whatever, oil refinery, as opposed to when we talk about carbon dioxide removal or DAC plants, where theoretically you can place that unit anywhere in the world. It doesn't have to be at a point of emission.
And for cement,
yeah,
concrete as a specific example, is it reliant on CCUS just because of the lack of ability to scale back cement production in any way because of aging infrastructure? Or is there actually is it also a feature of the process of actually making cement and concrete that makes it so difficult to decarbonize and abate?
Back in 2 years ago now, I thought I wrote like a 3-part blog on this. So I'm going to have to remind myself.
Right here.
Yeah. So we've got I've got here that cement is meant to account for 7-8% of CO2 emissions.
Yeah.
Globally, you don't really see any kind of slowdown in people building, pressures growing and so forth. So you do expect emissions from that sector and that world to kind of remain steady or increase. And I mean, there are kind of companies like Heidelberg Cement or what's the other one I forgot the name of. But cement companies are very interested in CCUS, to say the very least. So they are exploiting it. at the moment, and they're marketing it as low carbon cement. And yeah, I mean, people might be able to willing to pay a premium for that.
Sir, and last question we like to ask before everyone goes is we like to do these weird deep dives as big researchers, and so people find very strange things. Is there anything weird in the CCUS world? Has anyone found the strangest U in the utilization possible?
Strange things. It could be that some of the permanent sequestration applications, they, you know, it could be that they're going on for the first time, they're occurring for the first time. So there are some people who are worried that there is a risk that these CO2 emissions might actually leak at some point, which would kind of completely upend the entire purpose and process in the first place. And I was on a talk yesterday where one of our colleagues, Todd White, was talking about how that did happen at one point. I don't know whether the sequestration part of it, whether it was the actual transportation of CO2 to the sequestration site, but it happened in America. I mean, people were hospitalized because of CO2 leakages. CO2, I think, is denser than air. It displaces air. So, I mean, you've got some time to kind of get out of the situation before you get hospitalized. But in that particular scenario, I don't know when or what it was, but people were eventually hospitalized. But yeah, it's one of these things where we're trying it for the first time, especially with offshore sequestration applications. So there are questions about, you know, how permanent is that permanent geological sequestration? Who's going to be monitoring in it? Who's going to be doing the maintenance for that sequestration site? And if things go wrong, you know, who's going to be responsible for it?
Yeah. Wow, that's so interesting. I didn't know at all about the leakages happening from these. That's not a good PR for CCUS, which doesn't need at all.
Yeah, so yeah, Heidelberg Cement plans to make its Norcem cement plant in Brevik in Norway the world's first major cement CCS project, capturing 0.4 MTPO, 400,000 tons of CO2 per year. And that'll be online in 2024, apparently, this year.
Wow.
There you go.
So cool. Thank you to Serkan for joining us. To learn more, the report is available on Guidehouse Insights webpage. To keep up to date with the podcast, please feel free to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. We look forward to you joining us for our next conversation in May. Thank you to Guidehouse for providing us this platform of discussion. To keep up to date on larger Guidehouse Insights work, follow our Industry Insights blog on the website, www.guidehouseinsights.com. Thank you, Serkan.
Thanks, Serkan.
Thanks, all.
Cheers.